Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, we just finished a great conversation with Dr. Lee Wilkinson.
Wilkinson, just spelled the same way.
Spelled the same way, but no relation.
But you're not related.
We're not related, as far as we know. But he might be. Not only is he also here in the state of Florida, just as we are, but he's also a psychologist. Well, he's a nationally certified and licensed school psychologist.
Right.
He's a chartered psychologist. I think that that's from...
I think the next two...
Registered psychologist.
Chartered
also.
And registered. Mm-hmm. But he's also a certified cognitive behavioral therapist.
Right.
So there's a long
list of
specialties here.
Right, right.
But he's from the British Psychological Society. He's a member of the British Psychological
Society. Right, he's an associate fellow over there. So that's pretty cool. Right. And he does a lot of work. He has focused most of his work in working with students with autism spectrum disorder.
And he got involved. What I like about his perspective is that he was involved very early on.
Right.
And autism has changed over time, and he's been a part of that change.
Right.
So it wasn't that he's, like you, picked it up in 1994.
Well, 94.
You never used 3R.
No, I never used it. We talk about this in the interview, the DSM.
Right. Because you learned it, you started learning it after, with DSM-4.
Right. Well, I didn't really even get into the major of psychology until the end of the 90s, late 90s. I'm just saying.
Somebody kicked the camera.
Did you kick the camera?
Somebody did.
Richard.
I don't know who it was.
He has been kicking the camera.
No.
You'll see this in the interview. You'll see this camera just do like that.
Quivered a few times.
It wasn't because of anything else except
got cold in
somebody had to stretch out a little bit.
But I like his perspective because he's been there through all these changes in this disorder. And it really is interesting to get his perspective on things like the epidemiology and the incidence rates because he has a very different perspective on this disorder. So if you're and the least bit interested in special education because he's a treasure trove of special education policies and law, but autism in particular.
Right.
You'll want to take a listen to this.
Right.
Because the guy really knows what he's talking about. He's been at it a long time.
Right.
Has a great perspective.
Yeah, his experience in talking with him a little bit reminds me of the early training with Dr. Silver.
That's who came to mind.
Yeah. Dr. Archie Silver was who I trained with early on.
Yeah.
And he had that wealth of experience from decades of practice.
Decades of clinical work, of deep clinical work that we don't get today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this it's a great interview. He has a ton of work. You know, he's written for
and it's
journal
good
articles,
stuff.
He's written books.
This book that we read the second edition.
Right.
But the first edition of this book won some award.
Right.
A prestigious award.
Yeah.
So the guy knows what he's talking about.
He does. He does. So we hope you enjoy this interview. Links to all of his contact information is in the show notes. So follow him on LinkedIn. Follow him on his blog. He has tons of information out there.
And he stays current. The other thing that I like is that he reviews articles and then summarizes them.
Right.
So you'll get good quality, up-to-date information.
Absolutely.
If you subscribe.
Absolutely. Now, at points in the interview, we're doing this. We did this interview through Google Hangouts in the evening. And sometimes the internet isn't as...
there's too much traffic.
There's a lot of traffic.
It clogs a little bit.
Right.
Because it is different very early on Saturday or Sunday morning.
Right, when we do those.
Very different.
Yeah.
But it does get a little stickier.
Right. So there's a little bit of feedback sometimes. There's a little bit of It's just a little choppy. Mm-hmm. But stick with it. Most of the audio is just fine.
Yeah.
But definitely listen to this podcast if you have any interest in, like you said, special education, especially as it pertains to autism spectrum disorders, because mm-hmm. There's a ton of information in here. So.
Right. He knows what he's talking about.
Yep, absolutely.
So. Good interview. Good interview. Yep. And a very, very pleasant man.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Enjoy.
So hope you enjoy the interview.
Yeah.
And let us know if you have any questions. All right. Enjoy. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hey. Hey, Lee.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good. See me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a
little bit grainy, but...
The we never know how the internet connection and everything is going to work, so it's always,
always an adventure.
That's right. It's always exciting. How are you doing today?
I'm very good.
Well, fantastic. Well, we've been looking forward to this conversation all day long. We've had your book out, and we've been talking about it, and talking about what we want to ask you about, and can't wait to hear your thoughts about a lot of these things.
Great. I'm ready to go.
Well, great. Well, tell us a little bit about how in the world you got started working with kids with autism spectrum disorder.
Okay. Now, my first interest really started in the 80s. I was working as a school psychologist in my career. And I got referrals for kids that were different, for want of a better word. Didn't really know what to think of these kids. Couldn't really put them in a neat category. And about that time, too, I believe it was the DSM-3, added autism.
Right, right.
Yeah. Then in 1990, autism was added to IDEA as a special education category. And that really piqued my interest. And then, of course, Asperger's came along in 1994, mm-hmm. and that piqued everybody's interest.
Right.
And so... my interest continued from there, both in terms of research and in writing, always finding these kids fascinating.
Well, fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic.
So what was the initial interest? You remember years ago, even before you and I, these kids were just called mentally impaired or schizophrenic. Yeah. Schizophrenic, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this was... Right.
Yeah, they were called schizophrenic, infantile autism.
Yeah, that was it.
Mm-hmm. That was also too. You may remember refrigerator moms.
Yes, right.
Remember them? Oh, yes, I remember that very well.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much all of that. Of course, we've come a long way since then.
Right. Right.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
What was your initial interest in those kids? Was it their social skills, their language skills, the abrupt falling off, the abrupt deterioration of language? Because you were working as a school psychologist.
Correct.
So
correct. Most of the referrals came from about social skills.
And how old were the kids when they were in those days?
When they typically were around 7 or 8.
Okay.
So about
the start of school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the language issue also was interesting. Mm-hmm. As well as some of the repetitive behaviors, meltdowns were still are.
Right.
Meltdowns are very, pretty much, what's wrong with this kid?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I don't understand this kid.
Right.
Why don't they understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, we'd get a referral, and we'd like you to test this child.
Yeah, right.
Tell us what's wrong with this child.
Just like and, that.
Yeah. And don't you think they belong in special ed?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And in those early years, that could happen. Back in the 70s and 80s, teachers could just refer the children out. I'm not trained as a specialist. So they would they had the opportunity in those early years just to put the kid in a different classroom.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you were the person who had to do that.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
And that... brought a lot of challenges.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of perspective.
Absolutely. And as you were saying, you kind of went through that great history
yeah.
of autism spectrum disorder. But, you know, I started practicing a little bit maybe after you guys.
Lee, let me clarify. Lee. Go ahead.
So, you know, but throughout all of my training and everything, you know, I had the DSM-IV. So I've never had the opportunity to practice under DSM-III or anything. So we learned it in history.
He loves this part. You know, for him, this was a history lesson, you know?
That's right. But you know, we had DSM-IV and then the TR, right, of course. But in 2013, I think that was a significant, right, time when the DSM-5 came out, because that really... Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, between the DSM-IV, the TR didn't really do a lot. It changed a little bit, right, but not a whole lot. Nothing really diagnostically. Right. And then, so between the DSM-IV in 94, right? 94, right, I think. Right. And then the DSM-5 in 2013.
Right.
I mean, that 20 years, you have a lot of practitioners who had really only learned and only been practicing under the DSM-IV. So when the DSM-5 came out,
It
brought a lot of changes to this diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And a lot of controversy, and there still is a lot of controversy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And one thing I do mention in my book is for not only practitioners, but parents, advocates, to understand the difference between a clinical, yeah, assessment and diagnosis and an educational one.
Right.
There's just a lot of confusion about that.
Yeah, I'm glad you did that, because that is really essential, because I remember when that definition changed and parents were panicky,
right,
because they were convinced that their children were no longer going to receive services, and it was because of that DSM-5 versus IDEA mm-hmm. difference. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I like the way you treated that in your book.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I tell parents, there's, you know, they may come in with a diagnosis from a practitioner, the DSM-5, right, autism spectrum disorder. I want my kid in special ed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, they're not the same.
It's not that easy.
Mm-hmm. We need to see if your child is eligible.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it was always interesting, I thought, because prior to DSM-5, a lot of children who were diagnosed with Asperger's, you know, right, they couldn't get services under autism mm-hmm. in the schools a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, depending on how things work, they may be able to get services under OHI, other health impaired.
Right.
And then, of course, when the DSM-5 came out and you know, everything became autism spectrum disorder under DSM-5, then everybody was, you know, struggling with the fact that they're... Right. In essence, they got rid of the diagnosis of Asperger's. So, mm-hmm. you know, both ways there were these challenges for folks.
Yeah, correct. And I think there are some important changes. One of some of the things I like about it,
uh-huh.
is some of the emphasis, and sometimes we gloss over this, is they added sensory issues to the RRBs.
Right.
Very, very important. The other thing is it now allows comorbidity with ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was huge.
I never did that before.
You know? Right.
So I think there's some positive things about it. I like the idea that it's a spectrum.
Right.
Right.
Different levels of support. So I think there's some positive things about it. There still is a lot of panic, I think, about it. You know, I've had parents still say to me, my child has Asperger's. They're not autistic.
Right.
You know, so, and that starts a whole conversation.
Right.
Hey, Lee, that was one of the questions I had. Do you think that the spectrum has improved our work, or do you think it's improved our work, our understanding of the disorder, or has it made it more difficult?
I think both. I think it's improved our understanding. In viewing autism just as that spectrum,
mm-hmm.
and varying in levels of severity and levels of support. I think it's complicated also by saying, where does this person fit?
Mm-hmm.
Because no one fits in a nice you know that old saying. You see one kid with autism, you see one kid with autism.
Yeah.
So it created challenges as well. But to me, on balance, it gives me a better way of looking at autism and to communicate to others about autism.
Okay.
I tell parents all the time, too, there aren't any really clear separations along the spectrum.
Right.
You say, well, you're here, and you're over here, and you're over here. It is just that spectrum.
Right. Yeah, and I'm glad we've moved away from that categorical definition, you know, where you had to meet certain criteria in order to get the diagnosis and especially to receive services.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, categories are okay, I guess, to communicate maybe from one professional to another.
Right.
But the categories aren't very helpful in looking at those individuals within the category because they're all very different.
Right.
Now, it certainly has gained a lot of attention. You know, autism, I think, sort of filled a space that ADHD once filled. You know, everybody was talking about ADHD for a long time. And then, you know, just to be a little skeptical, you know, it seems like as soon as, whether it's a person in the movies or a very popular, you know, famous person, as soon as they have a child with one of these conditions, all of a sudden that becomes their mission and now everybody's paying attention. And so, you know, Comedy Central is doing a whole benefit for autism spectrum disorders, all of which is great. But what it seems has happened, of course, is as that attention has grown, what we're finding is this prevalency rate continues. It seems like every time there's a report about prevalency coming out, it's becoming more and more common.
Right.
What is your take on that?
I think you're absolutely correct. Media, social media, popular culture, we tend to grab on to issues and complex themes. Autism as the awareness piece of autism always amuses me.
Right.
When I hear, we need to be aware of autism. We've gone beyond awareness of autism.
Right.
Who is aware of autism?
Yeah.
And it's showing, you're correct, it's showing up everywhere. Unfortunately, I think that in many cases, I hate to use the term overdiagnosed. Maybe diagnosis isn't the best term. The term is overused. It's overapplied in circumstances perhaps it shouldn't. But I think that's the society we live in at the moment. And it's not easy to tell someone, well, it really isn't autism you're talking about. It's perhaps something else. Or your child is just different. You know, it's okay to be different. You don't have to be autistic.
Right.
You can just be different.
Right.
And you may not be impaired. You could have traits associated with autism. Doesn't mean you're impaired. Doesn't mean you can't function as a student or as an adult. So the figures, by the way, and I'm glad you mentioned this, the CDC figures of 1 in 68.
Right.
I tell people this all the time. It's not a representative sample in the United States. It's 11 sites. Okay?
Right.
It's only approximately 8% of the population that are sampled. And it's only 8-year-olds. So when we hear that, people go, oh my God, 1 in 68. Oh, that's, you know, my goodness gracious. Well, it's not a representative sample. I think if we look at the figures in schools, maybe becomes a little more relevant, meaningful, because we're probably looking at 1% of the student population.
Wow.
Okay. That's a pretty big difference.
That's a pretty big difference. Still a lot of kids.
Sure.
But more importantly to me, you look at the special education population in our schools. Autism has gone from 1.5% of the overall special education population to now 8%. So there's been a dramatic increase.
Right.
Some people will say, well, that's due to something called diagnostic substitution. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Right.
There used to be something else. Now it's autism.
Right.
And indeed, there has been a decline in IND, especially, and an increase in autism.
Right.
Make of that, you know.
Right. Yeah, I think that I agree. The challenge that I think we have right now diagnostically is that, you know, when we were trained, or mm-hmm. I know when I was trained, we were kind of under the impression that, you know, it's a developmental condition that you know, there's not a cure for it. It's a neurodevelopmental disorder. You have it. You can learn some strategies to cope with some of the limitations and everything. But today, I think a lot of people, you know, if you have a 3-year-old who's not quite talking yet, they're very quick to go ahead and place the label or to identify or categorize it as autistic spectrum disorder. And then they work from the perspective of, okay, well, and then let's see what happens. And then, you know, if they do well, then they don't have the diagnosis anymore. And I think it's part of it, too, is a philosophical perspective as far as what this condition is and what it means for the life of the individual.
Yeah, I think, again, because of the awareness, you know, parents are somewhat hypersensitive.
Right.
About their children. They're not talking yet. Or they're demonstrating some odd behaviors. You know, what is that? And that gets back also to a lot of things, many things I talk about in the book, is understanding normal development with kids.
Absolutely.
So very often we can say, or pediatricians will say, well, that's normal development. Your child is developing normally. However, if there are delays, very often pediatricians are also advising parents, well, perhaps it's autism, perhaps it's some other type of neurodevelopmental problem. We need to look further into it.
Right.
Lee, when you're advising parents, and you encounter these children with autism spectrum disorder, what is your mental outline of what challenges they're likely to face at home? Realizing, of course, that the severity of the disorder will be an important factor. But what are the major challenges that parents are going to be facing?
Okay. There's some recent research, particularly regarding moms.
Okay.
Suffering significant depression, mm-hmm. fatigue, anxiety. In terms of parenting a kid on the spectrum, financial issues crop up.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Marital issues.
Yeah.
Crop up. Sibling issues come into play. Mm-hmm. There's a sibling in the home. How much attention is devoted to that child on the spectrum? Right. Feelings of perhaps guilt or I'm not spending enough time. What do I do now? Again, the financial issues, if there's schooling involved, if there's other treatments involved. parents are more involved now, too, in terms of educating their children. So that's additional time as well. I think what parents tell me is stress.
Mm-hmm.
Stress. Right. One thing they're stressed about is what's the future of my going right. to be for my kid?
Yeah.
And parents will ask me, what do you think will happen to them? Will they get better? Will they get worse? Will they outgrow it? I hear that all the time. Will they outgrow it?
Right.
Those are difficult questions. Following a diagnosis, my experience is parents go through a real series of, I don't know what to do. I'm upset. Where do I turn to? Who should I talk to? They're very susceptible at that time to is there a cure?
Mm-hmm.
Where can I find something? There's got to be. Can I go to my doctor and get something? Mm-hmm. You know, it can be very challenging and bewildering, I think, for parents.
Right. Well, it's certainly a basic question because we've both worked in the schools. Actually, both Richard and I are trained as school psychologists as well. And, you know, having worked in the schools, I know that that was always a challenge because many of the things you mentioned, for example, are things that are beyond the scope of schools, that it's beyond academics, mm-hmm. You know, some of the stress that the parents experience and those kinds of things. Do you find that you had the opportunity to work with that's an important and a frequent thing that you work on with families of children with autism spectrum?
That's a challenge in the school setting, mainly because of time constraints and that other thing. I refer them, you know, to agencies, and refer them to community resources as often as possible. Respite care.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For many parents, it's a lifesaver.
Right.
For some parents. Communication with the school sometimes is not always the most positive thing, especially if the child is having really, really having challenges in the classroom. And so we have to work with teachers, parents, try to get them on, which a cliche, the same page.
Yeah.
Or at least in a partnership of some sort to communicate in the best interest of the child. So that, for school personnel, that is a real challenge, I think. Yeah. For teachers, having a kid in your class on the spectrum is a challenge.
Right.
Where the more capable kids, you know, 80% are educated in general education classroom.
Right.
Okay. You have a co-teacher, you might have a special ed teacher come in the classroom. Child might leave for a short period of time, but the classroom teacher's there, and he or she has that responsibility for managing that child behaviorally, educationally, sometimes without appropriate training, I might add. And that's a big
oftentimes without much training. So what would you say are some of the major challenges for teachers that are working to, especially general education teachers, yeah, who are trying to help work and teach these students?
Yeah. I in my working with them, I try to get them to understand the way the kid on the spectrum thinks.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How they process information, their executive function, right? You can't say, everybody line up now, 1, 2, 3, hurry up.
Right.
You may have to take a different approach. You may have to use a different strategy with the kid on the spectrum. So understanding some of the behaviors that they might see. Communication, some of the communication issues, and then some of the communication problems. The child's really not being rude, all right?
Yeah.
They're having difficulties communicating, or they're trying to communicate with you through behavior. So I talk about that too. What behaviors are you seeing? Maybe this is the way this child's trying to communicate with you.
Right.
So I really think teachers would benefit from a lot more in-service when possible in dealing with kids with special needs, particularly those on the kids on the spectrum.
Right. Lee, before we leave this school area, I don't think this was a specific question, but you mentioned anxiety earlier.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to me that these kids become very anxious because we don't know how to deal with them effectively. Is anxiety a problem that, is it a significant contributing factor in how they react and respond to teachers?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a good word. Yes. Good. Absolutely. The rate of anxiety disorders in kids on the spectrum is estimated anywhere from 70 to 80%.
Okay.
At least 50%, at least half, having a diagnosable anxiety disorder.
Okay.
Yeah, and it is a problem, and teachers have a tough time dealing with it.
Right.
Parents have really a tough time dealing.
Right.
I that's a very good point, and I think it's something we don't always pay attention to,
mm-hmm.
as psychologists, and even in assessment, I mentioned in the book, we need to take more time to look at coexisting, co-occurring, comorbidity, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
issues in kids on the spectrum, because it's often a very big issue. Mm-hmm.
Very
much so.
Okay. Can I ask another quick question?
Sure.
This gender gap.
Yeah.
Most neurodevelopmental disorders occur more frequently, most neurological disorders occur more frequently in males than females. Is that 5-to-1 ratio pretty accurate, and why more males than females?
Well, I think the five to one is, I believe, the CDC's.
Right.
Yeah. My experience is far more males than females in every category of eligibility, disability eligibility, special education.
Right.
And certainly in ASD or autism. The gender gap does exist. There's a lot of research that points that out. I've heard from adult females who have been diagnosed later in life,
mm-hmm.
who were originally given all sorts of labels, anxiety disorders, learning disability, shyness, described many different ways. I think the gender gap is real. I think part of it is due to the male model of autism. I think many of our assessment instruments tend to measure the behaviors most often associated with males versus females. I think that's true of many of our assessment instruments. Secondly, I think females are socialized differently than males. I think girls tend to have better communication skills. I think they tend to hide their problems better. They're less aggressive. They're less hyperactive. Mm-hmm. So I think they stand out less in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. So they might. Yeah, it'd be. It's the same with ADHD. Girls tend to have the inattentive form, where boys tend to be more hyperactive and impulsive. So boys come to our attention.
Yeah, and I think that's a good part of it.
So it could be similar with ASD.
Yeah, I think it is with ASD too. Even difficulties with eye contact or difficulties with socialization. Oh, she's just very shy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, or the girl who kind of isn't quite fitting in, maybe has one friend or has imaginary friends. I think very often we say, "Well, that's typical of girls. They make up.
Right.
You know, that's their play." I don't want to sound stereotypical here, but I think that's what happens, I think, when we look at the gender gap.
Right.
Is that we need to start applying a lot of stereotypes,
mm-hmm.
and we miss the picture.
Right.
Yeah.
I always say, my recommendation is anytime a girl who seems very withdrawn, highly anxious, seems very different by both parents and teachers, should take a closer look.
Okay.
Yeah. Good advice.
Good rule of thumb there.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the assessment a moment ago, and in chapter 4 of your book, the book is a best practice guide to assessment and intervention for autism spectrum disorder in schools. This is the second edition. The first one won, this was in your bio that you sent over, that we were looking over. You won awards with the first book, right? First edition?
Yeah, that was a winner in the education academic category of India Awards.
Well, fantastic!
Congratulations on that one.
Congratulations!
Oh, that was good.
It was good.
That's great.
Yeah, it's good. So, and that's the second edition. There was a need to up. I mean, things have changed so much in these past 6-7 years.
Right.
That absolutely need to update it.
Yeah.
Bring it current.
Yeah. Well, in chapter 4, you mentioned the comprehensive assessment as sort of being the best practice. What do you consider to be a comprehensive assessment?
Okay. When you mention best practice, like I mentioned here too, I use best practice and evidence-based practice interchangeably. And I describe evidence-based practice as really three components: research, the best research available, the values and of the family, okay, with the family values, with the child values, the child characteristics, and assessment. a comprehensive assessment. So that comprehensive assessment is part of best practice. A comprehensive developmental assessment measures a number of core domains across development.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Cognitive ability, language skills, social skills. I mentioned speech and language, adaptive behavior. All right, other domains too, sensory. I included in here, in the second edition too, an emphasis on RRBs,
mm-hmm.
restricted and repetitive behaviors. You tend to overlook those. Okay, they are a core feature of autism.
Right.
Overlook those. Even though we can measure those in some of the broader assessment instruments, I've included two individual self-report for parents, teachers, that can be used as well. So a comprehensive developmental assessment is just that. It's comprehensive across a number of developmental areas to get a comprehensive look at a child's function in a number of areas. And we kind of use that as a yardstick to measure typicality versus atypicality. Is this normal development? Is it not normal development?
Right.
What degree does it deviate from expectations based on the kid's age development?
Gotcha. Are there any particular instruments that you, we see sort of the idea of the gold standard with the, the Autism Diagnostic Interview Revised and the Autism Diagnostic Observation System, the second edition. We see some of these specific, autism-specific tests, and then, of course, the questionnaires like the CARS and the GARS and things like that. Are there any particular tests like that that you gravitate more towards, or do you feel, is it sort of your perspective that this overall evaluation really is going to capture most of the things you're looking for without necessarily a specific scale?
Yeah, I list a number of instruments in each domain.
Right.
Selecting those instruments depends on a number of things, age of the kid, the circumstance, classroom teacher, for example, the social responsiveness scale, which I love, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I use second edition, which I use quite frequently. Is very user-friendly for parents and teachers, at least I found. So that's one thing you could use in terms of looking at social skills in the classroom and at home across setting.
Right.
Cognitive. You know, we look at the gold standard Wechsler scales, I guess, okay, depending on age of the child. So it really depends. I think the important piece is that it is a psychometrically sound instrument. And I spent a little time talking about sensitivity,
mm-hmm.
which to me is very important. Right. How sensitive is an instrument? And I always tell practitioners, read the manual. Is this a I don't want to cast a dispersion on the GARS, okay, because mm-hmm. it's been beat up enough over time. But it is not a very good instrument to include in the comprehensive assessment pattern. Sensitivity is not very good.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean it isn't useful.
Right.
Okay. Under the right circumstances, good as a screening instrument, perhaps. You might use it as a supplementary instrument or something like that. But to use it as a standalone instrument to draw a conclusion, probably not a good idea.
Okay.
So I always tell practitioners, take your time, look at the psychometric properties, do your homework. I know it takes time, but you got to do it.
It's a little bit like IKEA. You know, if all else fails, read the directions, right?
That's it.
If all else fails, read the manual.
Read the manual, yeah. What does it say?
Yeah, that's right.
Sometimes the manual is, but do a little research and take a look. The instruments I've included in the book, I've researched, they have good psychometric quality.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A little bit better than others, but they're all pretty good.
Right. On to a stickier issue. You mentioned earlier that parents begin to look for cures. Remember years ago, do you remember Larry Silver?
Yes.
Okay, remember he used to do that update about bogus cures, and he published it in the pediatric literature. Is anybody keeping up with that in autism?
There is a site, internet site, mm-hmm. and I can't think it's something to do with false something or other, but it supposedly exposes.
It does.
I don't know who the person who runs the site, and I don't know where they're getting their information from.
Mm-hmm.
But I think parents of kids on the spectrum are particularly susceptible.
Right.
And who can blame them? They're looking for an answer.
Right.
Where there isn't any at the moment. And parents want the best for their kids.
Right.
They will go at any length to find something that's going to improve their child's behavior.
Right. Yeah. Of all the disorders, I think that the parents of children with autism spectrum disorder, I think, remain the most susceptible to bogus cures, and they'll travel to any lengths to get them.
Oh yes. Yes. Yeah. Just Google.
Yeah.
Google autism, and you will see. Oh my goodness. And I mentioned CAM in my book, complementary and alternative medicine. And I mentioned some of the research that is, it doesn't support it.
Right.
People might not like to hear it. I've done workshops, and I've had parents come up to me afterwards and say, well, I don't think you're correct. A gluten-free diet made my child a lot better.
Right.
And I said, well, I'm wonderful. That's wonderful. I said, but that's anecdotal. Mm-hmm. If it worked for you, it worked for you. But overall, we don't have research to say it's an evidence-based intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. I've had parents tell me essential oils have worked. What do you say? Well, if it works for you, It isn't an evidence-based intervention.
Yeah, that's what we've talked about that before, that many times in those kinds of situations we have circumstances, we have environmental circumstances that can elicit behaviors similar to autism or ADHD or lots of other things. And so when you go through chelation or you go through some of these other things and you see an improvement, it's not that you're curing autism, it's that you're mm-hmm. removing the factors that were contributing and creating the symptoms that we, right. maybe misidentified or incorrectly labeled as autism symptoms.
Right. In the first place, right.
Yeah, and there's some treatments that are just plain dangerous.
Right. Right.
Chelation being one of them.
Yeah.
Hyperbaric oxygen therapy.
Yeah.
So I'm hearing a lot about that now. Mm-hmm. Clearly not appropriate for kids on the autism spectrum.
Yeah.
There's no evidence to support that whatsoever. Multivitamin therapies, we can just go on and on and on and on and on. And on. Okay. I wrote down a few additional ones. Secretin, for example, hormone.
Right.
Okay. Probiotics. I tell parents, if your child, you need to consult your pediatrician, first of all, before you do anything related to medical treatments. It could be dangerous.
Right.
I don't know. Should be under supervision of your doctor. I've had a lot of discussions with parents about restricting their child's diet. Kids on the spectrum are notoriously picky eaters to begin with.
Mm.
And they have difficulties with nutrition. So you have to be very careful about withdrawing nutrition from your diets, gluten-free, for example. You should do that in conjunction with your physician. But, parents are very, very eager to find something. Stem cell therapy. Okay, didn't hear that. And that's right. Illegal in the United States, of course, but not elsewhere. Mm. So, you know, that's going to become a problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were talking before about IDEA and the way in which kids get services in the school system. Can you kind of share with the listeners the difference between like a 504 plan, RTI, response to intervention, and IDEA?
IDEA is special education. Right. It's an educational benefit law. You get an IEP, individual education program or plan. You get direct special education services. 504, section 504, is really a civil rights law, as you probably know. It prohibits discrimination against individuals with disabilities.
Right.
And for kids in school, it amounts to accommodation, not direct service. And sometimes it's a challenge explaining this to parents. If your child is eligible and under 504, you don't get a special education teacher. You don't get a special education individual plan. You get accommodations. You get extra time in the classroom. You might have a test read to you, so forth and so on, to your child, right? So there is a distinct difference. If a child is eligible for IDEA under one of the 13 categories, they're automatically covered under 504.
Right.
But there is a difference. So kids with 504 get accommodations, IDEA, you get direct service, you get an IEP. There are similarities, however, and that relate to, for example, due process and that type of thing. But they're very different in terms of the level of service that we'll receive.
Is there anyone in particular that you recommend for parents to look into for if they have a child with autism?
A parent comes to me and thinks, well, so-and-so said my kid has autism, or I have a report here that says my child has autism, special education. First look. Mm-hmm. Give me a first look. Because you want that child, again, a comprehensive evaluation in terms of school setting and eligibility. Does that child meet eligibility for a special education category? It may not be autism.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And as you mentioned before, it could be another disability category for which a child might be eligible. Speech and language is one of them, by the way.
Right.
So, a child might meet eligibility under another category. So I suggest parents, that's where you really need, go to your school, talk to your special ed coordinator, whatever information you have, request an evaluation.
Now, we've kind of covered a whole lot of different information. Anything else in particular that you'd like to share with the listeners, either places that you would encourage them to go to if they're thinking about diagnosis, if there's a particular practitioner or type of specialist, or because you know we hear differences between psychologists, neurologists, developmental pediatricians, any other bits of information that you'd like to share with the listeners?
One last thought about RTI.
Oh, great. No, perfect. Perfect.
This comes up a lot. You know, RTI has become very important to a whole lot of people in terms of eligibility for special education. And it is mentioned in the law. RTI is mentioned in terms of evidence-based intervention. And it really applies to kids with specific learning disability.
Right, right.
It doesn't apply to the other disabilities. And I've had a discussion with educators before.
Right.
RTI is not a substitute for a comprehensive evaluation.
Right, right.
Right. And I try to make that very clear because there is some confusion about that. I've had educators say to me, well, if they go through the various tiers of RTI and they're still struggling, can't we just make them eligible for special education?
Right.
Of course, my response is no. They need to have a comprehensive evaluation. And in fact, the law says that RTI is not a substitute for a comprehensive evaluation. So, having said that,
Lee, let me jump in on this one. the law that as passed by the federal government said that RTI can be used, a child can be made eligible through RTI or through comprehensive assessment. In Florida, it's only, we must do RTI first. That's mm-hmm. That's what we're told.
Yes.
Because that's a unique feature of the Florida process.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the idea is, well, I think RTI is an important educational step forward, quite frankly, from an intervention perspective.
Right.
All right, from what we used to do sometimes.
Right, agreed.
It's taking a few steps and say we need to increase intensity and so forth and so on, mm-hmm. how the kid responding, if it's done correctly. And I think it can be an important part of the overall assessment process.
Right, right.
So I think by going through RTI prior to an overall comprehensive assessment, mm-hmm. it gives you a lot of additional important information to use during that assessment.
Right.
Now, the problem I have with this is parents will often come in and say, I wouldn't like my child evaluated. And we say to them, well, we have to complete the RTI process first.
Right. Right.
They get upset and so forth and so on, and they say, I want my kid evaluated now. And then we get into further discussions at different levels and all that stuff. So I think RTI is part of the assessment process is a good thing. I think RTI in place of assessment process is not a good
thing. I think, what about insisting that we do RTI before we do an assessment?
And just to add on to that, the idea of, you know, because we find ourselves in this because we're in private practice now, parents will go through exactly the process that you were just talking about, and the school says, no, we have to do RTI first. And the parents will come to us for an evaluation and ask us to write a report that, you know, to send to the school. And then they get to the school, and the school still kind of holds to, it mm-hmm. doesn't matter, we still have to do RTI.
That's right. They won't. That's with, unfortunately with Florida. You know, Florida. That's what happens. That's, again, when parents come in, and then what they'll do is they go out for a private assessment.
Right.
They bring back in, and then they're frustrated all over again. It's like, you know, you just told me the same thing you just told me. Well, unfortunately, the school is telling you the same thing again. And so, you know, the response is, well, how many? You know, how quickly can we go through RTI? You know, and. If we have a child who is obviously in need of special education services, you know, my feeling is if you have sufficient data to make that eligibility determination, you should make it. To just say, well, no, we have to wait another 4 weeks. Really? You have sufficient information. Right. On the other hand, if you don't, if you have a bare bones report, and you don't have good school information to help you meet to decide whether it's eligible, then perhaps you do need to wait. You need to wait 6 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever, I don't know. But it'll just probably depend on the individual also.
Right. Yeah, it's. I know that it's frustrating and challenging because. You know, as you were just saying, you know, a school year starts, and so the teacher has to take, it takes a few weeks for the teacher to get to know the students and to get to see what's going on. And then they say, well, you know, there's something a little bit going on with this one. I'm a referring. And then, you know, then they begin the process, and it takes a week or two to meet. And then before you know it, it's Christmas break.
Right.
And nothing, you know, not much has been done, or maybe a first round or two of interventions have been done, and so the kid has now missed, you know, half the school year.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I know that's challenging. It's challenging for teachers, it's challenging for the kid, and it's certainly challenging for the parents who are watching all of it happen with very little ability to do anything about it.
Yeah, and I agree. School districts, you're in schools, you know what schools are like. They're organizations, they're systems. their cultures.
Right.
And every school district is somewhat different, but they all have their own levels, they have their own rules, and they have their own expectations. And where you fit in the school, you just become part of the system. And it unfortunately becomes frustrating for everybody. I think there are things that can be done as a school psychologist, wherever you're working, in terms of establishing relationships with coordinators, administrators, and that kind of thing that facilitates better service for kids. But in the end, we're all subject to rules and regulations.
It's always rules and regulations. There's a code of conduct for all of us.
Like it or not, I guess. Huh?
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, well, we don't want to – we really appreciate you talking with us this evening and – you know, those who will be listening can listen whenever, but this is, we're getting into the evening hours. So we really appreciate your time and all. Can you share with the listeners how they can follow, you know, get access to some of your works, your writing, any other work that you're doing? How would be best for the listeners to follow you?
Probably the best way is my blog, bestpracticeautism.com.
Okay.
I post articles. I try to keep up with research. I try to synthesize and summarize research for parents as well as professionals. There's information in there on the blog also about my books, obviously. So they can take a look at that. LinkedIn, if you're connected to LinkedIn in any way, I do have some groups on LinkedIn.
Right.
Yeah. That they can join. I think that's sometimes a good place to interact and gather information as well. Yeah. I hesitate to mention Facebook. I have a limited presence there.
An obligatory presence, right. Yeah.
Well, perfect. Yeah. Well, we'll include the links to all of those in the show notes so folks can follow you and learn more and hopefully interact with you. And you know, if they have any other questions or anything, they can pass some of that stuff on to you, too.
Great, and I appreciate it.
Lee, I really did. I really appreciated talking to you, and hope to do this again.
That'd be great. I enjoyed it.
Keep up to date. Right. Thank you.
Perfect. Well, have a great evening, and, you know, if you have any new books or anything else coming out, you get in touch with us and come on, and we'll talk about it and help push it out there for you.
Great, I appreciate that.
Okay. All right, great. Have a nice evening. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.